Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Müller is the world's finest magazine of cycling and cycling culture. Established in 2006, Müller interviews the world's biggest cycling names and covers the world's biggest cycling races. Visit our website at müller.cc and subscribe to support our in-depth features, long reads, independent journalism, stunning photography and immersive cycling coverage. I'm Edward Pickering, I'm the editor of Müller, and this is Müller Conversations. We've got a two-part podcast for you today. The second half will be an interview I did with Tour de France commentator Ned Bolting about his fantastic book, 1923, The Mystery of Lot 212 and a Tour de France Obsession, which is out next week on June the 22nd. It's a great book and it was an interview I enjoyed immensely. That's in a bit, but first I'm going to catch up with James Start for the regular feature on Müller Conversations that I'm not sure he would like me to call Start at the Finish. James has been at the Critérium du Dauphiné, so I'm going to tap him up for all the gossip and colour from the race, and apologies in advance for the slightly low quality of the audio. James's logistical shenanigans have meant that he's phoning in from a petrol station somewhere between the Alps and Mont Ventoux. So, James, thank you very much for joining us. Why are you somewhere between the Alps and Mont Ventoux?
Well, it's just the way things happen. I was at the Critérium du Dauphiné, as you said, and then I also do on Tuesday after the Mont Ventoux Dénivelé Challenge, which is the only one-day race that finishes on top of the Giant of Provence, Mont Ventoux. It's a wonderful race, and now I'm driving back down to the Ventoux Classic to get back on a bike tomorrow for that race. So, yeah, it's all part of the being a cycling journalist is in this part of the season for sure. As we're gearing up for the Tour de France, and it's just one of the high points of the season, so we're kind of running around in different directions, which puts me at a petrol station somewhere between Annecy and Vaison de la Romaine.
So we spoke the day before the time trial last week about the Dauphiné, and the race had been a little bit sprinty up to that point. And I'll just recap the Alpine stages for our listeners. There were two stage wins for Jonas Vingegaard and one apiece for Georg Zimmermann and Giulio Ciccone. But the biggest story of the race was Vingegaard emerging as the overall winner, quite a long way ahead of Adam Yates in second place. And there was an Australian trio of Ben O'Connor, Jai Hindley and Jack Haig, who came third to fifth. And I only had one eye on the race because I was up to a few different things that weekend, but I did have enough of an eye on it to know that it looked like quite a straightforward win for Jonas Vingegaard. So, James, what were your impressions of Vingegaard?
Well, it was pretty much Vingegaard and the rest, huh? I think coming out of this Dauphiné, when you're looking at the Tour de France, just on paper, huh? On paper, the only person that can touch him is Pogacar. There's a question mark around his health as he comes back from the fracture he suffered at the Liège-Bastogne-Liège. I have a feeling he's going to be on form at the Tour. I think it's going to be a two-man Tour. But right now, at the Dauphiné, it was a one-man show.
What's he like close up watching? Because I find him kind of impenetrable. And he's currently got that air of invincibility, which is kind of hard to crack. What's he like close up when you're watching him at the race?
Well, he doesn't give much away. He's a very private person. If you remember, in the upcoming issue of Rouleur, the Tour issue, we interviewed Pogacar. And I asked Pogacar, I said, what's your relationship with Vingegaard? Are you friendly or what? And he just said, does anybody have really a relationship with him? And he wasn't really, it sounded very aggressive, but it really wasn't. He was just saying he's a very private person, doesn't do a lot of social media, and that seems to be the way. I mean, what is really clear to me is that he's a real family guy. I mean, he gets on that home train, the wind trainer, after after each stage to turn his legs, and he's on the phone immediately talking to his wife. Then his wife came with their kid, and he just couldn't take his eyes off his kid. He's such a family guy. It's really quite obvious. The whole big stardom of cycling, I think, is just beyond him. He doesn't really want to be bothered with that. He happens to be very good at racing a bike. He, like Pogacar, they're good at everything you do. They rarely get into trouble. They always are well-placed. They ride smart, and they're strong. I don't think that when the race is over, when he goes home, he's thinking about the bike race very much. I think he's thinking about, what can I do with my kid, talking with his wife, things like that. And I got a few pictures of him after one stage, just riding the rollers, and his kid was there, and he just could not take his eyes off his kid. So I think that says a lot about who he is, to be honest.
Does he give any sense that he feels pressure? Because obviously a lot of people seem to be of the opinion that he doesn't love all the hoo-ha about bike race. And what you've just said underlines that as well. But does this manifest in any way externally? Can you tell from observing him close up, as you do, that there is pressure on him? Or is he impervious to it?
Well, there is pressure on him. And I think that's where he finds solace in his family. I think he finds shelter there. And, after the tour last year, he barely raced again and was really struggling with the stardom stuff and all the attention and everything. And he just was mentally wasted. But, he was very good in press conference. He answers questions very well, very thoughtful. But he's one of those guys which is very, I think a lot of these people, they're very focused on their own performance. They spend a lot of time with their computers, with their watts, with their power stuff. And that's part of the DNA of the modern professional cyclist. As a result, they think more about their own performance than that of the competition, which is interesting because in many ways, cycling is an individual sport, right? Even though it's run in a sort of team format. So he was asked, what do you think about Pogacar? And he's just like, well, I don't really follow Pogacar. I'm really focused on my own training, my own performance, and whatnot. And he was asked, how are your numbers this year compared to last? And he's like, well, we changed our computers and our tech, so you have to actually ask a trainer who can compare those numbers better, but I feel good, obviously. So just very focused on his own performance and himself.
He was clearly stronger than everyone else by a long way as well, wasn't he?
Just danced people off his wheel. I mean, the first, I was at stage four, so I only got second in the time trial to, was it Mick O'Bear?
You can be
who, tremendous under 23 TT champion three times, and just scored his first pro win here, right? A huge win for him. But I was like, okay, McBear, I know the guy's a good time trialer, but beating Vingegaard, I did not expect. So I was like, well, maybe he's not as good as we think. But then you look what he did to this competition. Well, he just dusted him. And then the next day confirmed it because he dusted him again on the climbs at the end of the stage. And that just sort of shows the difference in levels here, I think. Vingegaard is clearly at a different level. And the only guy that I can see being a serious contender on paper is Pogacar.
What about Adam Yates? I mean, he was obviously quite a way behind Vingegaard, but I did get the impression he was clearly the second strongest rider in the race. And I was looking back at his career. And, he's not a young rider anymore. He's ridden 11 Grand Tours now. He's had a couple of fourth places and three ninth places. And I kind of suspect that if he was going to be a real Grand Tour contender, we'd have seen it by now. But best of the rest behind Vingegaard automatically puts him in still quite a rarefied position.
It does, but he is racing with the same jersey as Tadej Pogacar. And I have a hard time seeing him, unless Pogacar is not as good, I have a hard time seeing him be the leader of the team. I think he got hired on because he's done 11 Grand Tours, because he's probably not going to win a Tour de France, and yet he's going to be a key support rider. That said, anything happened to the Tour, what would Vingegaard have done 2 years ago if Roglic had a bad Tour? Because he went in as a support rider, and it was only after it was clear that Roglic was not on point that he showed his stuff and finished second. So we'd be curious to see what Yates would do if Pogacar is not on point. But I happen to think Pogacar is going to be pretty on point.
For me, the other stars of the show were the mountains, the scenery, the climbs. There was a finish on the Col de la Croix de Fer, which is often used in the Tour de France to get from the north of the northern approach to Alpe d'Huez. The climb, which we talked about briefly last week, the Citadel in Grenoble, which also just looked fantastic, both aesthetically and from a sporting level. So what were they like on the ground? How were those two climbs?
Oh, they lived up to their expectations totally. I mean, the Quad Fair is a magnificent climb. I love it. I've done a mountaintop finish there a few years ago for the Tour de l'Avenir, and now to the Dauphiné. So that sometimes ASO, they start testing out the possibilities of a mountaintop finish by running some smaller races up that. This was the highest summit finish ever in the Dauphiné, I believe. And are they preparing a coup for the next 2 or 3 years with the Tour finishing on the Quad Fair? Could be. It's a wonderful climb. Just kind of climbs out of the lush lower lands and then over this mountain lake. It's pretty impressive. And, you know, Vingegaard just rolled away from everybody once again. And I love the Bastille climb, which is, yeah, that citadel up above Grenoble. And we used to do it in the 1990s. I remember doing it, I think, probably the first Dauphiné I ever did, which would have been probably like 93. I think Laurent Dufault won it that year. I can't remember exactly. And so I was really excited when we went up it again. I mean, it has a long history. Bernard Hinault winning it there after like crashing in a ravine, stuff like that. I mean, a lot of history has been written on that climb. And it's a steep climb. It's like 10, 12, 15, 16%. It just doesn't stop. It's unrelenting. And I've seen, you know, cars get stuck on it. More than one cyclist put their foot down. It's really brutal. But it was a great way to finish up. Great racing. I mean, they didn't just wait for the Bastille, say, like they do at Flèche Wallonne with the Mur de Huy. They were racing over all those climbs. Julien Alaphilippe went on the attack. It was his birthday. He clearly wanted to win a second stage. But it was Giulio Ciccone. He was in the break with Alaphilippe. I didn't think he was the strongest. And then he just skirted away from them and nobody saw him again. And he was really strong. He came to the foot of the climb with, what, 30, 40 seconds maybe? 2 kilometers straight up. He never relented. He didn't look bad. He never looked like he was struggling. I mean, yeah, he was struggling. Always struggling watching him. But, you know, he kept a good rhythm all the way up there. And Vingegaard did not catch him. And he won a brilliant race. It was a beautiful victory for Ciccone because he was focusing on the Giro. And they got COVID right before. He was out. And so this was a great way to come back. And he's such a wonderful kid. He's so much fun to in the press room. He's so lighthearted and jokes, and I always like seeing him do well because he's just a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah, it's funny. We talked about this last week, how those stages in the Auvergne fit in with the stages in the Alps, and it's interesting. There's often a gulf in perception between watching a race on television and how people view it and being on the ground at a race. I think races are very different experienced on the ground than they are experienced through the television screen. But I still sense a kind of diminution in the prestige of the Dauphiné. And I sometimes struggle to wonder what it's for, whether riders really target it or whether it just happens to be a convenient hit out just before the Tour de France. But what's the perspective from where you were on the ground? Does it feel like a prestigious race when you're there?
Oh, yeah. I think, if anything, it's almost more prestigious now. I mean, when you got the defending Tour de France champ showing up on Tour de France form and really using it, and then you've got pretty much how many other contenders? It was stuffed with Tour de France contenders, podium contenders and top five contenders. And they had an amazing week of racing because on paper, what you don't see is those Auvergne stages don't have an inch of flatness. I mean, it's just always rolling, which might explain why this pure sprinter struggled. But for the guys riding the Tour, it was tremendous.
Great. Well, James, I'm going to let you get off to Mont Ventoux for tomorrow's race, which will be yesterday by the time the podcast is live. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Ed.
And next up, after a quick break, is Ned Bolting. There's great news for the Rouleau Conversations podcast. Our sponsor for this episode is Caldera Lab. Caldera Lab have developed an exciting range of high-performance skincare products which combine pharmaceutical-grade science with nature's purest and most potent ingredients. A leading clinical trial found that 9 out of 10 men experienced healthier and visibly improved skin after using Caldera Lab products. And we've got an exclusive offer coming up for 20% off Caldera Lab's best products. So, like most cyclists, I've spent a lot of time outdoors. Cycling keeps me young inside and very happy, but all that sun and wind does contribute to the ageing process of my skin. The laughter lines are a little more visible than they were 5 or 10 years ago. However, Caldera Labs sent me their regimen bundle, and I can already see the beneficial effect that it's having. The Clean Slate is a balancing cleanser that refreshes my skin. The base layer is a nutrient-dense moisturiser which is quickly absorbed and just makes my face feel less dry. The Good is a night cream that reduces visibility of wrinkles and fine lines, and I also look and feel a lot less tired because the Icon Rejuvenating Eye Serum has taken down those dark circles and the puffiness around my eyes. Caldera Labs are also committed to transparency, sustainability and excellence, and they are on a mission to make men's skincare better. They use clean ingredients, they are a certified B Corporation and a member of 1% for the Planet, so they're helping the world as well as the confidence of their users. Upgrade your skin and your confidence with Caldera Lab. Ruler Conversations listeners can get 20% off at calderalab.com with our code RULER, and that's CALDERALAB.com. Go to calderalab.com/ruler, and that's 20% off. Unlock your youthful glow and be ready for summer with Caldera Lab. I'm interrupting this podcast to remind all listeners to subscribe to Ruler, the world's finest magazine of cycling and cycling culture. Our latest edition, out now, is Ruler 120, the Tours issue. Ruler 120 is two magazines in one. We have two front covers, one for the Tour de France Homme and one for the Tour de France Femme, and each is packed with in-depth features about the races, their personalities and the culture around them. Ruler 120 features an exclusive interview and photo shoot with the double Tour winner Tadej Pogačar. In a revealing chat with Ruler photojournalist James Start, Pogačar reflects on his journey through cycling and opens up about his relationship with the sport as a whole. Also in Ruler 120, exclusive interviews with five-time winner Miguel Indurain, French champion Audrey Cordon-Rageau, the fastest rising sprinter in the sport, Charlotte Akul, plus Jean Etienne and Aurora Amaury, whose family has owned the Tour de France for generations. Also the original voice of cycling, Phil Liggett. We also chat with Betsy King, the pioneering and irrepressible North American cyclist who raced in the Tour Féminin during the 1980s. And we've got features about the Puy de Dôme, the iconic mountain which returns to the men's tour for the first time since 1988, the Gave de Pau, which is the tour's spiritual river, the flowers of the Tour de France, and much, much more. Ruler is the world's finest magazine of cycling and cycling culture, and Ruler 120 is available now. To support our journalism and receive a magazine every 6 weeks, please subscribe. Go to ruler.cc, hit the subscribe button and enter the code PODCAST15, PODCAST15, to get 15% off our regular subscription price. And now, back to the show. I'm with Ned Bolting, cycling and darts commentator, raconteur. I couldn't think of any other way to describe you in your capacity as a frontman of a one-man show. Editor, Ruler columnist, and thank you for submitting clean copy on time. And now the author of 1923, The Mystery of Lot 212 and A Tour de France Obsession, which is out on June 22nd.
Correct.
And published by Bloomsbury. Ned, welcome to Ruler Conversations.
Thank you very much, Ed. Thank you.
I've read it 1.5 times now. It's right up my street, Ned. Increasingly, maybe this is a function of my increase,
don't say it.
My
don't say it.
Years, my age. But the most interesting thing about cycling is everything else.
Yes.
And sometimes the most interesting thing about cycling is what is not happening in the bike race. Road racing is kind of a conduit for me to understand and explore the world, learn about it. And you've written a book which I think does just that, because I've been struggling to classify this.
Mm.
Is this a cycling book,
first
and foremost?
It's a really good question. I learned quite early on in my sort of journey in publishing that books are like tins of beans, and that they are simply a commodity that you purchase, consume and throw away if you want to. And in that regard, publishers want to know where it sits in the supermarket. Is it with the cereals? Is it with the fresh fruit? Is it with the wine? Very clearly. And you know when you go to a supermarket and you're after something slightly indeterminate, like flaked almonds,
Yeah. Which are the Flaked
Almonds? Where the hell are the Flaked Almonds? Are they going to be with the baking products, or are they with nuts? Or, you know, those sort of things that slip between the gaps? Supermarkets don't like that. They don't like things that aren't clear. Publishers equally don't like books that aren't very clearly...
You must have had a nightmare selling this one.
So this is problematic, you know. On the plus side, I think when it is published, it's going to sit in both the sports section, the cycling section, and the history section. At the moment, my publicist just sent me a little link saying it's the number one bestseller at the moment on the Amazon charts. Don't buy it on Amazon, but that's a reference in the Tour de France, but also in the history of Belgium and military history of World War One.
Quite right too. We will get onto the military history of World War One at some point, as you did in the book. So let's get the cycling out of the way. This book is about the... No, let's not get the cycling out of the way. Let's go do that. What is this book about, Ned?
Well, it is about a lot of things. It's about a thing that happened to me during our shared and common experience that we all struggled through of the pandemic. And the thing that happened to me was like a bolt of lightning. It was pure chance when a colleague of mine who has absolutely nothing to do with the world of cycling happened upon a lot at an online auction that he thought might interest me. It turned out I was pretty much the only person on planet Earth that was interested in this lot. And I bought at auction a reel of projected film from a long time ago, whose provenance was unknown and whose contents were unknowable at the time. And I didn't pay very much money for it, and it came into my life, and I eventually, through a long-winded process, managed to get it restored and digitized. And it's a 2.5 minute film of quite clearly an edition of the Tour de France, a stage on an edition of the Tour de France.
So the first job, if you were already thinking of this in terms of the jobs you had to do, was finding out when this took
which
place.
Day. Yeah. And that in itself was a very educational process, because I don't know whether you knew this, you're steeped in cycling history, I'm learning and trying to play catch up, but I had no idea until I was presented with this conundrum that there were 5 editions of the post-World War I Tour de France that were literally identical. I just didn't know that.
Yeah, they had the same routes every year.
They had the same routes every year for 5 years, consecutive years, until they started to break the race up into slightly smaller fragments. So that was interesting, and the year in question happens to be one of these years, which led me to that itself was problematic, because which one was it?
And how did you know it was one of these years?
Because I did the simplest thing. First of all, the first thing you see on the film is basically a stage map, and it says Brest to Les Sables d'Olonne, 412 kilometres. Yeah, stage 4.
Helpful.
Very helpful. So first thing I did is put into Google Brest to Les Sables d'Olonne, 412 kilometres. Got an instant hit that I didn't look beyond that said that'll be the 1923 Tour de France, which it was, actually. But then I got sidetracked because I started to read around the subject a bit, and I picked off my shelf Albert Londres' famous book, Les Forçats de la Route, yeah, the convicts of the road, about the Pelissier mutiny in 1924, just because it was kind of close in time. And as I was reading that, he literally talks about the next day was Brest to Les Sables d'Olonne over 412 kilometres.
That sounds quite similar.
Identical. So then I thought, well, it could be 1924 then. And then I looked and found there were 5 consecutive years that were identical. It could be any one of these. So that kind of set me back. But that was just the very beginning of unpicking of all the detail in the book.
Yeah. And before we get on to the rest of the story about that, it kind of got its tentacles into you, didn't it, this film?
Hugely.
It kind of took a real hold of you. And why do you think that was?
Well, I come back to your original question, what's this book about? Which I really should have been prepared for. But the first thing that occurred to me was actually, Ed, the book's about me and my experience, because I was deeply affected by the pandemic. I had a young family whose lives were, like many of us did, you know, put on hold, and I felt terrible for them. And I retreated within myself a little. And I found solace in this project that became more and more the central thing of my life. So the more I was horrified by the Downing Street briefing at 4 o'clock and the COVID charts and the sense of will it ever be back to where it was, which I think we all had that deep dread that the world was changed forever, the more I retreated into the events of 100 years ago and found actually striking and chilling parallels between what was going on in the world back then and what is going on in the world now. So the echoes drew me in. It's quite morbid at times, but it worked as an escape hatch for me.
And then you kind of happened upon the person who turned out to be one of the central characters, probably the central character, but apart from yourself,
yeah,
which is Théophile Beekman's. Beekman. Not a journeyman, too good to be a journeyman, not good enough to be a star, but a rider of the era. And he became a big part of your journey into this Tour de France.
Yeah, absolutely. He did become central to... it's a difficult book. I don't want to spoil the content of the book because I want the reader to come on this journey of discovery with me. But you're right to flag up this rider, and I don't imagine anyone listening to this, however rouleur-y you are, will have ever have heard of Theophile Beekman, because frankly, even though he won two stages of the Tour de France and finished just off the podium in the Tour de France, among other notable achievements, he was not a great. He was just very, very, very good. And also completely forgotten, even in his hometown, which is in Ninove, which, if you do know your recent cycling history, will ring a bell, because Ninove is ingrained in East Flandrian folklore, having hosted the finish of the Tour of Flanders for many, many years, and still hosts the finish of Omloop Het Nieuwsblad. So it's a cycling-obsessed part of Belgium, but no one remembers Theophile Beekman. So I took it upon myself to become the guardian of his personal and professional history. And I'm sitting here in a soundproof booth in Somerset House in London talking to you in the certainty that no one on planet Earth knows more about Theophile Beekman than I do, including his living descendants who I tracked down. And it's a very odd position to be in, Ed, because of this chain of coincidences. I have prevented his name from being completely erased from history. Why he and what he does in the film have smashed through the icy crust of frozen time now is pure chance. But that's what's happened. So he's dodged oblivion because of this strange coincidence.
Yeah, it just so happens that the film that you bought at auction is not very long. Two and a half minutes.
And incomplete, because I think the projected film burnt on the bulb. So you don't actually see who wins the stage.
No. It's very compelling, very mysterious. I've watched it a few times. There's a QR code in the book which you can scan and watch the movie. It's incredibly affecting, especially having read the book as well. But it just so happens that one of the captions did flag up his name, incorrectly spelled. But that just gave you a little hook, didn't it?
A little, the tiniest of hooks. I mean, the incorrect spelling wasn't helpful, but very characteristic of the way the details of his life have been. Even his family don't really know how to spell his surname. So within their family, there are two different versions of spelling, so it's kind of interchangeable, which I find extraordinary.
Apt for Belgium as well.
Maybe it's a very Belgian story. That yes, that was enough. That was like trying to sort of climb a kind of ice wall and just being given a little pickaxe to chip away at. And once I'd sort of identified him and started to research his personal history, then it became my mission to think, well, okay, we know who that rider is in this bit of the film, but there's other shots where you've got multiple, you've got the whole peloton envisioned, basically. I wonder who he is. But this is black and white film from 1923. They all look the same. You know, they all look the same. It's very, very, it's hard enough in 2023 to identify the peloton, isn't it? But this was a real challenge. And then I went, well, is it possible to pick out, like, are there any star riders in this particular bit of the film? Turns out there were, and it's littered with them. And here I don't want to give away too much, but in this film, captured are truly some of the greats of that era, with the most extraordinary biographies, some of which are quite well known, but even if you don't know them, they're worth retelling, and those stories get retold in the book as well.
Yeah, and that difficulty of identifying is kind of a metaphor for the way we sometimes look at life itself, because sometimes life moves a bit fast, that you don't see the details, you can't see the snapshots, and with your film, when you freeze the frames, yeah, the quality is so grainy and hard that it makes it more mysterious
in
a way.
It absolutely does. It's incredibly frustrating, actually, that the only way of looking in detail at this film is to run it in real time. Because as soon as you start like slowing it down, the distortions just get amplified, actually. Equally, it's incredible how many weeks, literally back-to-back weeks and months of my life, I have spent looking at a 2.5 minute reel of film. I close my eyes, I can play it back in my head, and every single frame is imprinted in there.
Yeah. And you know, there's so much serendipity involved as well, isn't there, with just people who are in the film, but also the fact that it's 100 years ago this summer. I mean, we're in June now. These events, it was 100 years ago this month.
June the 30th.
Yeah.
June the 30th, 1923, is the day on which the film was shot, and that's just around the corner. And it absolutely thrills me that it's the exact... In fact, June the 30th this year is the eve of the Tour de France. It's the day before the Tour de France starts.
Perfect, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you don't want to give away too much about the people in there, but the book is also populated by quite a fascinating list of dramatis personae. I mean, Bakemans is the central figure, but obviously there are other riders, the people who won the Tour de France, the major riders, also Henri Derigange, Willy Verhegger, who's a poet, who I met him a few years ago.
You've met Willy, yeah?
I interviewed him for my book about the Tour of Flanders,
because he's a
basically
book?
The poet laureate of the Tour of Flanders, and he also wrote you a poem for this book. But the supporting characters, cyclists, non-cyclists, athletes, politicians, people in the literary world, they're also a central part of this book.
I mean, completely. So my source material for almost all of the research, and bear in mind, most of this research happened during COVID, so I was sat at my desk, was the unfathomable depths of the Bibliothèque Nationale, which is on the online resource, free to access for anyone, of the French National Library. And they have scanned in all the newspapers from that era, and there are lots. So there was a great wealth of stuff. And once I'd sort of mined it for all the cycling information I could get out of about the Tour de France, it really started to engage with what was going on the front pages and on all the other pages, on the arts pages. And you know, so I started to look at the broader context of, like, as you said, like, it's a conduit into a world, isn't it, road racing? And so I started to look at the historical and cultural context in which the bike race was happening, which let's not forget, these riders in the peloton, in the film, were all part of the lost generation. By definition, none of them could have got through those years of the First World War.
Just remind us who the lost generation were.
Well, it was a phrase coined by Hemingway, who is a character in my book. He features a lot because, you know, Hemingway's connection and devotion to road racing and cycling is actually quite profound. And his personal biography interweaves in startling ways, I found out, with Ottavio Bottecchia, the Italian cyclist, who's also a character in the film. But he coined the phrase, or rather, he quoted his literary mentor Gertrude Stein in Paris, and she described rather dismissively Hemingway's sort of like slightly pompous, morbid character. She said, "You lot, you are all the lost generation," by which she meant your lives have been broken by your experiences of the First World War, and as a result, you're doomed.
And also, let's not forget the flu pandemic of
the Spanish flu. I was writing this in the middle of a pandemic, writing at times about a pandemic. It was, and of course, the great tragedy of Spanish flu was that it operated in an opposite way to the COVID pandemic, because it affected more than anyone else the young, and there was no vaccine. And there was only one way out, and that was herd immunity. And the only way of achieving that was through colossal loss of life. So the scarring of that generation ran deep in the peloton, you know.
Yeah, and like we've said, the Tour and sport do not happen in a vacuum. And no sporting event takes place or is inseparable from the wider culture in which it happens. So give us a bit of background on 1923, because I get the impression you're interested in history. Maybe military history and geopolitics.
Yeah, I didn't really know I was, Ed, until I started to become interested in... Well, military history never interested me at all, but I became borderline obsessed with the year 1923 itself. And I'm not a historian, not a trained historian, I've never kind of like... But the more I started to scratch away at it, the more I started to feel that this is a very significant year in European history. There's a thing going on in June 1923 that is called the occupation of the Ruhr. It was that part of the aftermath of the Treaty of Versailles. The French and the Belgians decided that Germany was not meeting its repayment terms, its swingeing repayment terms. And they literally, first of all, occupied the Rhine Valley, but that wasn't enough. They then, in early 1923, moved further into Germany and confiscated Germany's industrial output in the Ruhr Valley, so steel, coal. They literally loaded up onto trains and took it. That provoked the wave of hyperinflation in Germany that peaked in 1923. And its absolute peak was in November 1923, just weeks before Adolf Hitler tried to seize power in Munich. This is not nothing that's going on here, right? My thesis then became that this is the junction between the end of the First World War, the afterglow as the guns are cooling of the First World War, and the firing pistol to start the Second World War. For my mind, happened in 1923.
Yeah, and all this stuff was happening on the very eastern, well, beyond the eastern border of France, the race that
is right over
on the west, which makes you think, well, they're two separate things. But actually, the Tour de France was used almost overtly and explicitly as a statement of French geopolitical unity.
100%.
And you've mentioned this in the book as well. Also, there's a little snippet which I love, which is got an old map of the Holy Roman Empire, which I would recommend any listener to this, any reader of Ruler, to just look into the Holy Roman Empire, because the history of how Central and Western Europe became the way it is now is a long and impossibly complex thing. But these events in 1923 are entirely bound up with that, aren't they?
Completely. I mean, another point in history that resonated for me as I contemplate these big themes. See, I'm a linguist. I studied French and German, and so I'm kind of feel like that I'm slightly straddle both cultures.
Alsatian, maybe.
Maybe. I've got a bit of an investment in both sides, and they are so mutually exclusive in some ways. And I suddenly remember, you know, talking about this old enmity, First World War, Second World War, and even before that, the Prussian, Franco-Prussian War of 1870, very important, and before that, then Napoleon, his incursions into Germany, all that. But then in my lifetime, I remember seeing, and I was a kid at the time, maybe 12 or 13, in a newspaper that my parents had unfolded on a kitchen table, I remember seeing that iconic photograph of Helmut Kohl, the German Chancellor, and François Mitterrand, who's half his size, holding hands outside the ossuary in Douaumont near Verdun. The significance of that probably escaped me at the time, but now I think back at it, I think that's extraordinary that finally France and Germany, and now, of course, you know, Macron, the seat of power in Berlin and Paris, and they are driving the big European project, for better or worse. I think it's for better. You know, it kind of prevents Europe from falling apart. So these are big themes, and they boil down to, you know, extreme prominence in 1923.
Yeah, but there's more to life than geopolitics, and you've also talked a lot in the book about Paris in 1923 was a cultural and artistic hotbed. The people who lived in Paris around that time was like Hemingway, James Joyce,
Ho Chi Minh,
who was obviously not a cultural figure, but a political figure, honing his political chops in Paris. There was Gertrude Stein, who was an incredible sponsor of all the arts, and poetry readings. And so tell us a bit about that aspect.
Man Ray,
the kind of Dadaist photographer.
Yeah.
There's so many fascinating characters all convened in Paris in this time, making it probably the most avant-garde place maybe that there has ever been.
I think Paris has had many peaks, you know, of importance, but I think one of them happens around about now. And there was an idealism that bordered on desperation about abroad in Paris at that time. So, you know, if you think back to Paris in the Belle Époque before the First World War, before the birth of modernity, you know, that's one thing, isn't it? But it's a rather cozy world.
It was nice, wasn't it?
It was nice. Yeah. It was nice. This, what's going on in Paris in 1920 isn't necessarily nice. It's just exuberant and risky and brittle, but just overwhelmed with kind of like grand ideas and this sense that everything is possible now. It is the birth of modernity, isn't it? This is what's happening. What I love in particular is the way that, you know, we live in a very kind of separate world now, where you study art or you study sport, and they're very different worlds. Well, in Paris in 1923, they're not, are they? Hemingway's obsessed with sport, and he's right on the sort of sharp, cutting edge of a new form of literature as well, and moving in all these circles. And equally, that some of the great sporting figures are heavily invested in the arts as well. Henri Desgrange went on to, you know, found a newspaper called Comédia, which was about the arts. There's a fascinating character called Victor Bayet, who I'd never heard of, who plays a central part in kind of the birth of the Tour de France. But he straddled into literature as well. And even, I write, one of the other characters who pops up, about whom I knew nothing until I started writing this book, is a boxer from Senegal called Battling Siki. But he, when he's not boxing, behaves as if he's a kind of Dadaist poet. He wanders around with lion cubs on a lead, and he feeds them absinthe. And he got arrested at one point because he fired a starting pistol in a theatre. You know, and he's just like, all these characters are just off the scale for me.
And there was one more overlap between the world of arts and the world of cycling, which it pops up every now and then. Alfred Jarry, who you've got a lot of time for, Alfred Jarry, who was a kind of dissolute waster of a genius artist.
And died a long time before this. I mean, the connection is a little bit more fragile with Jarry, because he died before the First World War. I think he said before the World War. Yes, he did. So he died tragically young. But he wrote a play called Ubu Roi, which was performed in 1896, which by coincidence happened to be the year that Théophile Beckmann was born. His personal biography overlaps with all these other characters in interesting ways. But Jarry was not only the most extraordinary alcoholic. I mean, his intake, I've detailed it in the book, is just the stuff of legends. No surprise that he died penniless at the age of 32 or whatever it was. But he was an obsessive cyclist as well, and he wrote some absolutely bonkers material about cycling that it's almost impossible to understand because only he understood it.
Yeah, and just to link it to cycling in the present day, you heard a commentator, a French commentator, use the word ubuesque.
It was Madiot.
Was it Madiot? Okay.
It was Marc Madiot. He described, this is going back a few years, in an interview, he described one of his riders going on some hopeless breakaway, you know, that was doomed, as ubuesque.
Fantastic.
And at the time, I didn't really know what he meant, and now I do.
Yeah. And I mentioned about half an hour ago that we were going to start with the cycling. We didn't start with the cycling, but just so there's a bit of cycling for our listeners, can you just tell us what happened in the 1923 Tour de France, what the sporting side of it was?
It was very important. It's not one that, you know, people don't remember in the same breath as 1924, which was famous for the Pélissiers' mutiny, but it was the end of a seven-year run of Belgian victories. So France hadn't won the Tour de France since the First World War. In 1923, that series of defeats, which were considered defeats, was put to an end by Henri Pélissier, his only Tour de France victory. But he was a rider who'd already won an awful lot and should have won the Tour de France several times over, but he had this absurd relationship with the race and with Desgrange and kept flouncing off in all these different ways. In 1923, though, the stars aligned and he put that to rest. But it also was the emergence of the man who would go on to win two tours thereafter, the first Italian to win the Tour de France, Ottavio Bottecchia. So really, in terms of the general classification, it's a story of those two riders.
Did this book end up how you thought it would when you started it?
Good grief. No. And actually, you know, if you're interested in writing and the way books are written, Ed, you've written... How many books have you written?
Four or five.
Four or five?
Yeah.
I would imagine, knowing your books and the ones that I've read, that every book you've written has sort of roughly 20, 22 chapters. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
Something like that. And those chapters are of a certain length.
I remember my agent saying, oh, that chapter's a bit short. I said, well, that's how long it's meant to be.
I suddenly realised that's the only way I knew how to write books. Every book I've written had been roughly structured like that. I couldn't do that with this book. It was too... Because the universe just shatters into so many pieces here.
I was going to use the word fragmentary.
It is very fragmentary. So I had to use a completely different narrative style, which you'll see when you read the book, but which was, as a writer, was really quite a journey. And I only mention that by way of saying I set out to write a book, but I didn't know what that book was going to be until I'd finished it.
Yeah.
And that's not something I've done before.
Did you find what you were looking for with this book?
Yeah, but it's not over. I can't begin to tell you how deep this book sits within me, Ed, because only a couple of weeks ago I was at the Giro and I was shocked to see that Mount Etna had erupted in almost exactly the same manner that it did in 100 years ago, on the same slopes as well, just to the west of Catania,
yeah,
as it did in 1923, where it was particularly active. So that, you'll understand when you read the book how much that resonates with me. Etna has exploded again. These after echoes of 100 years ago just keep popping up. And then stuff is happening in the real world to me, like there's a little town in Brittany, which features quite extensively in the book, called La Roche-Bernard. Beautiful place, such absolutely stunning little place. And a day after the Tour de France finishes this year, I've been invited by the mayor and by a couple of the characters who I met into La Roche-Bernard they're hosting a civic reception for me. Yeah. And they're going to show the film and do a little Q&A with me. And nothing thrills me more than that.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
I mean, six people might turn up, but I don't care. You know, I'll be lucky if I get six.
And you said in the book, right, the shadows of history cast both forwards and backwards.
Yeah.
So, and that extends to today, and it will carry on extending for weeks and months.
I think so.
To come.
I think so. I think it's it's Pandora's box. I opened something, I had no idea what was about to fly out.
Yeah. So, Ned, I really enjoyed the book.
Thanks, Ed. I can tell just by your questioning that you've understood the project.
I hope so. I'm going to read it again, or I'm going to finish reading it for the second time.
Wow.
It's the kind of book I think that you can go back into, because there are so many little nuggets of history, cycling, politics, art, culture, geography, everything is in there. So I'd really recommend our listeners get hold of a copy. 1923, The Mystery of Lot 212 and A Tour de France Obsession, out on June 22nd, published by Bloomsbury. Available all good bookshops, probably bad bookshops as well.
But I'd like to think so, yeah. Amazon is a spectacularly bad bookshop.
Yeah, but buy it from an independent bookseller if you can. And I hope you all enjoy it as much as I did. Ned, thank you very much for coming on Roulette Conversations.
Thank you, Ed.
You have been listening to Roulette Conversations. Ruler Conversations is made by the editorial staff of Ruler magazine. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Ruler and on Instagram at Ruler magazine, or visit our website at ruler.cc. This episode was produced by Amber Miller of Content is Queen.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.